From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As infections and deaths from the coronavirus continue to rise in the United States and in nations like Russia, India, and Brazil, some parts of the world are offering a model for how to beat the deadly disease. One major success story is Hong Kong, where out of more than 7 million residents, there have been only 4 deaths attributed to COVID-19. The backdrop for this stunning statistic is that the past year saw Hong Kong all over international news headlines for a persistent pro-democracy movement that refused to back down in the face of police heavy-handedness and a pro-China government. Now, it appears as though that very movement, rather than Hong Kong's discredited leader, is responsible for organizing a successful response to the coronavirus. My guest is Joy Ming King, activist born and raised in Hong Kong, who's been participating in the pro-democracy protests through organizing and direct action both inside and outside Hong Kong through his work in the Lao San Collective. Welcome to the program, Joy Ming.
Thank you for having me.
So we had last spoken last year when these pro-democracy movements were going strong in Hong Kong, showing no sign of backing down. It would have been expected that COVID-19 could have devastated Hong Kong for various reasons. It is an extremely densely populated area. Its leader is not one that has much sway within the population. And there are direct links to Wuhan, China, where the virus had its first hotspot. In other countries like South Korea or New Zealand, you've seen some, you know, remarkable leadership from the government, from the head of state. In Hong Kong, you have Carrie Lam, the chief executive, who is really not respected by, it seems, a majority of Hong Kong's residents. So how is it that out of more than 7 million residents, there have been only 4 deaths? To me, that's just incredible.
Yeah, Sonali, that's right. It's a very impressive approach and handling of the virus. But as many have pointed out, it is attributed, should not be attributed to the government, which has largely been seen as incompetent. And if anything, has created more obstacles than it has been helping in the management of the virus. So yes, as many as pointed out, the handling of the virus should be attributed to the informal networks between different parts of civil society that have emerged after the protest movement really proliferated last year. A lot of networks that protesters themselves created to, for instance, monitor police movements or to provide mutual aid have now been reappropriated and converted as resources provide information and mutual aid during the coronavirus outbreak. I remember when I was back home in Hong Kong over the winter, as early as late December and early January, when the first reports were emerging from Wuhan that a new virus was coming, among protesters, there was already a widespread call to wear masks everywhere as a matter of public safety and public health, long before the government took any sort of action to make this public service announcement. And actually, it's sort of a interesting historical irony that masks and mask wearing is very much a convention of protesters in Hong Kong that they've adopted to protect themselves and also as a sign of protest. And, you know, at the end of last year, the government actually passed a mask ban that, you know, made it illegal for protesters or people gathering in large groups in public to wear masks. And so when the coronavirus pandemic began, it was very much emerging in this context of masks as a political protest device. And protesters saw this as an opportunity to both extend their protest and also take on very proactively a public health measure that the government actually faltered in calling for people to put on masks for a very long time.
So the masks were meant as a way to protect their identity last year during the pro-democracy movement, because, as I'd mentioned, the police response has been heavy-handed. And in fact, Hong Kong's police has come under international scrutiny for its brutality, well-documented brutality. But now the protesters saw it as a dual function, a tool, one that protects them from police and protects their identity, but also protects them from this disease. It seems as though Carrie Lam's response to, or position rather, on mask wearing was similar to the United States CDC, which was to initially discourage the public from wearing masks because there was a fear that there wouldn't be enough protective equipment for healthcare workers. This ended up in the US, of course, really muddling the message, confusing people, and ended up sort of hampering and undermining the public's need to wear masks. So Carrie Lam herself seemed to have taken a similar approach.
Yeah, that's an excellent observation. There are so many parallels, actually, between the Hong Kong government's approach and the US government's approach. As you said, both have been very slow and incompetent, and actually have politicized, I would say, their response to the virus in ways that hampered the relief efforts. If I can point to more things that the Hong Kong protesters themselves have done in this time to fill the gap left behind by the government, there have been lots of volunteer brigades delivering masks to the elderly, to people living in small, low-income apartment buildings. There have been initiatives to track each case, creating crowdsourced databases of the latest virus news. And another large event that occurred earlier this year, when the virus was still starting to emerge in Hong Kong, was a massive, unprecedented strike by hospital workers in Hong Kong, which demanded most of all the closure of the border with China. And it was seen as what was necessary, essentially, to keep Hong Kong safe and also to keep our frontline hospital workers safe. But I also want to put forward a different, a more nuanced perspective. I don't want to whitewash and sort of glorify the response by the Hong Kong society to the coronavirus, because there are also aspects of it that can be criticized. For instance, it was revealed last week that many people returning from countries like South Africa, Bangladesh, and Nepal, returning to Hong Kong, are asked by the government, or actually sent by the government, to government-run quarantine camps that have appalling sanitary conditions. And for some reason, it's these countries that are being affected. People coming from hot spots like New York, America, the UK, are not asked to do the same thing. And so there seems to be a very racist handling of quarantine measures by the government. And also with the medical workers' strike, you know, a lot of xenophobic and nationalist sentiments actually drove some of the conversations around whether to shut down the border with China. Regardless of its effectiveness as a disease control measure. And so we see that on both the government side and in the civil society side, extra considerations that are more political have sort of infiltrated the discourses around how best to handle the virus.
So going back to shutting the border with China, it sounds as though you're saying it was a grassroots demand for the government to shut the border before the government actually did so?
That's right. The government, I mean, for many reasons, you can imagine, for symbolic purposes or political purposes, the Hong Kong government and the Chinese government did not want to shut down the border between Hong Kong and China, because it is a reminder. If that were true, it would be reinforcing this separation between the two places that the government would not like to see. And it would also sort of give credence to the idea that Hong Kong has the autonomy and power to determine its own borders, which again is another thing that would undermine the idea that mainland China and Beijing has ultimate sovereignty over Hong Kong. And the demand for shutting down the border obviously came from both the medical workers themselves, who some of them saw it as a purely scientific and necessary disease control measure. But you can also look in the online forums where a lot of far right parts of the protest movement have seen this as an opportunity to declare Hong Kong independence, for instance, or achieve some sort of political agenda that is sort of overriding the priorities of disease control. And so it's a very complex picture that we have, what is driving these developments.
Well, it is a very large protest movement. And I suppose anytime you have such a widespread movement, there is going to be a spectrum within that movement. So if there have been only 4 deaths in a city of more than 7 million people that are, densely populated, this is, Hong Kong is, public transportation is usually jam-packed, restaurants are jam-packed, streets are jam-packed. Was there, in addition to the mask wearing and restricting travel from China, what other tools helped to achieve this stunning result? Was there aggressive testing, which I imagine isn't something a pro-democracy movement can do? That has to come from the government. Was there contact tracing? Was there a lockdown?
There actually, in terms of lockdown, Hong Kong has had relatively lax restrictions. People have kept going to work. Public transports have remained open. Most restaurants have remained open with some restrictions on how many people can be in the restaurant. But schools have closed, which is, I think, probably the most serious restriction in terms of lockdown. But overall, compared to other countries, definitely compared to the US, Hong Kong's restrictions have been very mild. I would attribute Hong Kong's success actually more to its history of dealing with many plagues. I mean, even in the 20th century, Hong Kong has had many major plagues. And more recently, in 2003, there was the SARS epidemic. And so the history of dealing with these epidemics has instilled, I think, in the society and its memory, a cautiousness and an alertness towards disease. And people very intuitively will wear masks, even if the government is telling them not to. There's a distrust of the government and institutions, and instead a reliance on yourself and on other people around you to build mutual support. And I think similar cultural factors have been observed in other East Asian countries, and their success with the virus has also been attributed to a general sense of caution towards epidemics. And I really think that the protest movement has also contributed by building these really important support networks and infrastructures that protesters have now sort of remobilized to serve the pandemic control cause.
So definitely a public awareness, a long-standing public awareness of how to deal with diseases. So I imagine there's a culture, obviously, not just of mask wearing, but hand washing and sanitizing, etc. And we've seen that in countries, in places like South Korea, also in Taiwan. But interestingly, Singapore has had a very different response, even though Singapore is one of those countries known for its, stringent cleanliness. And I believe that the number of cases there has skyrocketed because of its immigrant workforce that is shoved into closed quarters in unsanitary conditions. A lot of immigrants from South Asia, and that's where you're seeing the numbers in Singapore sharply rise. But Hong Kong also has a large number of South Asian immigrants, right?
That's correct. But I would say the main difference between Hong Kong and Singapore is that Singapore, their migrant workers live in government-run dormitories, which are notoriously unsanitary and really densely populated and very easy for diseases to spread in those quarters. Whereas migrant domestic workers in Hong Kong, primarily from Philippines and Indonesia, who perform domestic work in their employers' homes, they live in their employers' homes and are not living in government-run dormitories. But there are still parallels in that migrant workers in both places have experienced a disproportionate level of precarity and vulnerability to the disease and its economic impacts. For example, in Hong Kong, there were surveys conducted among migrant domestic workers that showed very few of them have been provided masks or any kind of protective equipment by their employers. And because of the epidemic, a lot of employers have forbidden their employees, their domestic workers, from going out on Sunday on their weekly day off because of a fear of contracting the virus. And that's totally against the law. But as has been true of the history of migrant domestic workers in Hong Kong, the government is not keen or enthusiastic at all to enforce the laws that protect these workers' rights and instead give leverage to employers to basically do what they wish. And so in this crisis, we see a lot of the old problems in Hong Kong society actually becoming intensified.
And yet only 4 COVID deaths. I mean, I keep coming back to that because it's so impressive. So aside from mask wearing and I imagine stringent hand washing and sanitizing, what about testing and contact tracing, which is something that China's government has aggressively done. And of course, I imagine contact tracing is something that Hong Kong residents might be wary of, given that it requires the government to essentially, you know, keep tabs on individuals. So has Hong Kong managed to beat this virus without widespread testing and or contact tracing?
I would have to say that the testing and contact tracing have been essential, of course, as the technical ways to contain the disease. And generally, I think the Hong Kong society, the population of Hong Kong, will still trust in these scientific measures, which is very different from, for instance, parts of American society, which has developed this very anti-scientific attitude towards disease control. I mean, look at the protests happening in Michigan, for instance. To call for rapid reopening of the lockdowns of these states. So I think that in the popular discourse of Hong Kong, there's still an attitude that there's still a trust of medical workers, for instance. Frontline medical workers have a lot of respect. And so with regards to the scientific handling, the testing and the contact tracing of the virus, that has been important and necessary in Hong Kong's approach and should be credited. But I would also point to other things that are more problematic. For instance, a widespread attitude that mainland Chinese people generally are disease carriers. And for instance, there have been restaurants that put up signs that say no mainland Chinese people allowed or only Hong Kongers allowed.
Wow.
And so you see a strange blend of disease control, you know, scientific approach to handling the virus, marrying with very clearly anti-mainland racist xenophobic sentiments. And so, yes, there has been a very successful approach to the virus in Hong Kong, but at what cost? And I'm not saying that it's one way or the other, but I would want to complicate the picture more and
sure.
to see how, in many ways, there are other side effects to Hong Kong's success story, so to speak.
It seems as though the trust in science is critical, especially if one wants to go back to some sense of normalcy. I just want to pick up on what you were saying about anti-lockdown protesters in the U.S. and in Michigan. I mean, these are folks who are part of Trump's base who say that they don't think the economic cost to a lockdown is worth it. But of course, coupling that with an anti-science attitude just brings on more death. One can actually choose a path to reopening, to economic prosperity, if one actually trusts the science. But you can't both reject science and reject lockdowns, right? I mean, it just seems antithetical to one another to do that.
Yes, but I think that in both places, you know, even though there is a difference in how people understand and trust science, it's clear that in both places, the mismanagement of the virus and dealing with the virus has provoked a lot of outrage and distress among people who simply have no understanding of how to get out of this this crisis and have no grasp, no control over their realities, both in Hong Kong and in the US, in different ways, of course. But generally, there's a theme, I think, of a total distrust in the government and a suspicion that there's always some political machinations going on in the background that is somehow getting in the way of us getting out of this virus. I mean, in Hong Kong, it's very clear within the last week, so much has happened in terms of the government increasing its tight control over every part of our society and our legislature. And they're using this moment caused by the pandemic, this opportunity when the protest movement is at a low ebb, when everybody's concerned about the pandemic, they're using this opportunity to push forward a lot of massive incursions into our civil liberties and our rights that they've been thinking about doing for a long time.
So then that leads me to the question of where the pro-democracy movement is right now. If this is a movement that has led the way in helping beat back the virus, are protests continuing? Is there a long-term goal? And, you know, at the same time as addressing where the movement is, where is Carrie Lam's political future right now?
I mean, it's very hard to say. Looking back at the past year in Hong Kong, I think that we've all learned not to make any predictions because it's so unpredictable what can happen in a matter of days or even weeks. But I would say that looking back at the past few months during the pandemic, it is true that the protest movement has subsided somewhat, but there is still a general sense of preparedness and alertness and a readiness to get back into it as soon as the pandemic subsides. I mean, even during the pandemic, protesters did not really stop. They sort of redirected their efforts to find other ways of becoming, getting prepared or fighting the virus. Or for instance, when the government chose to use some public housing apartments as their quarantine centers without consulting the residents nearby, there were big protests against these attempts to commandeer the public housing. And so I would say that the protest movement actually is just sort of recalibrating and trying to muster again the same kinds of massive energy that made it possible to explode last summer. And I think the upcoming, you know, really important dates, June 4th and July 1st, are both very politically sensitive dates for Hong Kong and its history. And so on those dates, I think we will see more political action.
Explain the significance of those dates.
So June 4th is the commemoration of the Tiananmen Square massacre that happened on June 4th, 1989. And actually, the government has already taken a step to extend its lockdown measures, or rather its social distancing restrictions, all the way to June 4th. And many see this as a blatant political move to ban the annual vigil that happens to commemorate the Tiananmen Square massacre on June 4th. And then July 1st, of course, is the commemoration of the handover back to China. Typically, there's an annual march on July 1st against the government. And last year on July 1st, there was a massive, massive march against the government that was sort of a high point early on in the protest movement. And I'm sure this year, too, there already are preparations underway for something similar. And the government, I'm sure, is also mobilizing to counter it.
Are protesters flouting the social distancing rules that the government has put into place in order to, you know, further their protests? The government has indicated that people should be keeping distance, between one another, which I imagine is a little bit tough to do in such a densely populated area. It seems as though the government is intent on keeping those measures in place, perhaps because of political reasons. And I imagine that protesters that might be defying those also see their defiance as a political act?
Absolutely. It's long been true, I think, for the protesters in Hong Kong that, you know, the government is going to hide behind things like science and medical practice and rules to try to implement their authoritarian measures and agenda. So there's long been this idea that sort of to think strategically about how to navigate around these rules. And in fact, you're absolutely right. Just last week, Hong Kong protesters gathered again in malls across Hong Kong to sing protest anthems in defiance of these social distancing rules. And protesters gathered around a mall where a year ago, or 11 months ago, I'm sorry, one of the first protesters in the movement to die fell to his death there at this mall. And there was a large gathering there. And police were, of course, on the scene trying to break it up and disperse protesters. So it has become much more difficult, absolutely, to continue the protest movement amidst this pandemic and amidst the widespread police crackdown. But protesters are finding every opportunity to continue the movement, for sure.
Well, Joy Ming, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your insight and analysis of the story.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Joy Ming King. He's an activist born and raised in Hong Kong who's been participating in the pro-democracy protests through organizing and direct action through his work in the Lausanne Collective. We've been discussing the role of the pro-democracy movement in the COVID-19 crisis. Hong Kong has had only 4 deaths attributed to the disease. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.